As the federal government takes a new shape, South Dakotans reach out to their congressional delegation for help. From SDPB, today is Thursday, April 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a conversation with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. We'll talk with him about what South Dakotans are calling his office about. We'll also dive into national security and cybersecurity, and we will ask what the senator wants to know about a chat Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth had with Hegseth's wife and personal lawyer. Then, every town, big and small, has buildings that have served multiple purposes over the years. We will check in on how a single conference room can bring nonprofits together in uncertain times. That's later in the hour as we look at the role of philanthropy in the state. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. U.S. Senator Mike Rounds says his office is fielding hundreds of requests from South Dakotans negatively impacted by President Trump's efforts to restructure the federal government. The office is busily addressing constituent complaints and has identified $20 million in grants, loans, or operational costs at risk of cuts. Senator Rounds joined us from Pier for an update on tariffs, national security, and the rule of law. What are constituents in South Dakota, what are South Dakotans saying is really top of mind for them right now?
Once you've worked your way through the weather and the drought that we're currently in, they are concerned about President Trump's tariffs. They're really concerned about what that means for the stock market, for a lot of them who are retired, what their 401ks look like. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you move into a lot of the activity that's going on with DOGE and, you know, what impact it's going to have and, you know, how we respond to it and what do we do about it if it impacts us directly. And then along that same line, there's always, a discussion about, you know, the political scene in terms of, you know, where do we go from here? You know, what are you guys doing in terms of responding or sending messages back to the White House about what's working and what's not? Those are, you know, that's basically the kind of discussions that are occurring right now. Yeah. When we talk individually with people, a lot of them, you know, they recognize that the federal government, that the executive branch is, you know, huge and that we've got to do something about the $37 trillion debt. And, you know, they know we can't, it's not sustainable. But they also want to make sure that if we're going to make cuts, everybody knows what the cuts are going to be and where they're going to come from and that it not be done with a sledgehammer. And they kind of feel that the DOGE kind of did a sledgehammer, which surprised a lot of people. They thought Elon would come in with more of an AI-oriented program and be a little more sophisticated in the way that they shut things down. And so a lot of our discussions have circulated around that and making contacts back in, fixing a number of those issues that have already happened and working through it one case at a time, just trying to make sure that things that have been done by accident get repaired.
Yeah. All right. So the projection now is a chance of recession in the U.S. has jumped from 25% last fall to 40% now, according to IMF. There are real concerns about these policies and how they're going to impact the economy. What is your response as a senator?
Yeah, I think it's a response to the immediacy of the tariffs being introduced at a really, really rapid rate and without the opportunity for people to respond with good business decisions to them. I think it's going to change. I think the probability of a recession will go back down again as the president rethinks his position in a number of those issues, particularly with regard to China and Canada and Mexico. I think you're seeing some of that right now where the president is kind of drawing back and publicly acknowledging that he's getting good results from other countries coming and visiting with him. And I think that's the path forward for actually getting away from some of the tariffs that he proposed in the first place. And I think the more he talks about it publicly as being successful, the better chance we've got of having the vast majority of the tariffs recede into the background again. Mm. So we're watching it carefully, and we're talking with businesses that because of the uncertainty surrounding those tariffs, they have their livelihoods, you know, at risk. And we're going to be sharing those with the executive branch saying, look, if you're really serious about any of these tariffs going into effect, we've got to make sure that these businesses that really take, you know, products from overseas and enhance them, add value to them, add, you know, work to them, and have a good payroll here in the United States, when it looks like some of those might go out of business because they can't afford to pay the tariffs on those items, mm-hmm. that's when you got to rethink the approach you're taking. And we'll be back in touch with the administration, letting them know that this may not be working the way that they had thought it would in the first place, and expecting that they will make exceptions for those types of things that are being added to our supply chain, and in doing so, provide really good jobs for American citizens. They've got to take that into account.
Okay, so this reminds me, Senator Rounds, of a conversation you and I had when Donald Trump was running for president, and I asked you about the tariffs, and you said, well, you got to not just look at what he says he's going to do, but what he actually does, because he is a negotiator or a deal maker. Now he's actually done some of those things, and I think my next question was, well, if he does these things, what's your role? And now what I'm hearing you say is my role is to push back on the White House. Am I misinterpreting anything
there? Yeah,
that's
right.
Okay.
But no, but our role on it is to support their basic concept of fair and free trade. I think what he's saying is we don't have fair trade today, and he wants to make it more fair than what it was. And he doesn't get much of a disagreement among Republicans or Democrats to the fact that we have not had fair trade. And that a lot of our production is tariffed when it goes into other countries. Our businesses, when the response is we'll put a sales tax or a tariff on the items coming into the United States that our businesses use, sometimes that can be counterproductive, and that's got to be taken into account. So we will advise the White House about what we're seeing, you know, on the ground, and make recommendations where possible about modifications. But I can also tell you that even as of today, I know Secretary Bessent has made it clear that China and the U.S. will be entering into negotiations, and that it appears very likely that those really significant tariffs that the president had said he was putting into effect won't be around very long, and that they will be reduced as China is also reducing what their threatened tariffs look like as well. So I think, you know, once again, it's not necessarily the way that many of us would do business, but this is what the president wanted to try. And now he's negotiating with these folks. And hopefully this is a very short-lived impact on our economy, and that the economy comes back rapidly as a number of these tariffs are reduced, as trade deals are restructured.
You mentioned DOGE and people being concerned about some of those cuts. You and I have talked about this before, but the proposing cuts of something like 200,000 jobs from the Pentagon civilian workforce. Meanwhile, President Trump wants to ramp military spending up to $1 trillion. So in that context, do you have concerns about cuts to the National Security Agency, cuts to our cybersecurity agencies and the work they're able to do, the intel they're able to provide? Are you concerned about those cuts?
Yeah, look, I was concerned when they made some personnel changes that I thought were not warranted. And I made that very clear in public testimony in terms of information that we did publicly by our I am chairman of the Subcommittee on Cybersecurity, and I made mm-hmm. my dissatisfaction known in that committee hearing, mm-hmm. And that's for the public record. And I think, you know, moving forward, we need to have stability within our cybersecurity team. And we also have to have a significant increase in the amount of money that we're putting into AI-generated tools that we use to offset the offensive capabilities of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. They're using AI today, and we're going to have that incorporated even more so in our defensive capabilities. And you can't just always be on the defense. You've got to have offensive capabilities that you can threaten with them with as well. And anytime we get into a conflict in the future, it will be fought on five domains or in five domains: the air, land, and sea, but also in space and in cyberspace. And the place that it will start will be in cyberspace, where they do their best to limit our offensive capabilities by getting into our systems. And they'll try to break down our defenses as well so that their offensive systems can be more productive. You have to recognize that today, and you'll see that as they manipulate and try to impact society in general in the United States before they actually attack our space equipment or before they get into a conflict involving our weapon systems, whether it be aircraft or ships and so forth. So most certainly, I am concerned anytime they start talking about taking apart any part of the Department of Defense without having a plan to make the improvements in place.
Have we exited the cyber battlefield with Russia?
No, definitely not. There was a 12-hour period of time during negotiations that were going on in Doha, where as a part of those negotiations, by tradition, you relax your offensive capabilities during a negotiation period. That lasted for about 12 hours, and that was it. And everything is back in. We are continuing our offensive and our defensive capabilities on Russia, to the best of my knowledge. And and once again, we've always got to have our defenses up. The question is how deep are we, and are we doing specific offensive operations, you know, all the time? Some offensive operations have to have presidential approval. Some of it is directed to the Secretary, of Defense, who then relays that back down to our cyber teams. But since there was a provision put in called NSPM 13, National Security Policy Memorandum 13, that was done during the first Trump administration, which streamlined the process in which offensive operations are cleared with other departments to make sure we're not stepping on anybody else's toes. But it's been very successful. And so far, the president has continued that, not just from his first term, but the Biden administration continued it forward with some minor modifications. And the Trump administration has continued it forward as well. So that consistency has been very helpful in terms of keeping our offensive capabilities in line and available for use. What we need is to have trained professionals from all of the different departments that can work on our national cyber teams. And under what we call Cyber 2.0, it's a training not just of the manpower, but also bringing in the new sophisticated equipment and software capabilities that are associated with AI-generated tools. And that's where we're going right now. It's been expedited by this administration. And once again, we're very excited about seeing it successfully implemented, not in a matter of months, but rather in a matter of days. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Trump administration had directed the Secretary of Defense to have happen.
You mentioned Secretary of Defense Hegseth. Let's talk a little bit about his, we've now learned there was a second Signal chat where he shared information from Central Command with his wife, his personal lawyer, his brother. Anyone else would be in legal trouble for this right now. What's your current thoughts on what needs to be done next with the Secretary and this incident?
The first thing I want to know is did this occur before or after the more popular or the more well-known one that occurred with regard to the Yemen attacks that everybody found out about back in March? If it occurred beforehand, that's one thing. If it occurred after that time and after he basically was taken to the woodshed by the White House, that's a different story. We have, on a bipartisan basis in the United States Senate, on the Armed Services Committee, both the chairman and the ranking member have joined in a letter asking the Inspector General to investigate this fully. And based upon that investigation, we'll make our determination about what should happen next. But I can tell you that classified information should never be revealed or discussed on even that Signal application. Even though it is an encrypted program, it is not an authorized communication channel. It should not have been done in the first place, and it should not be done by anybody today. Encryption works and can help in terms of privacy issues, but until such time as we have an encryption system which is approved, it should not be used for the release of classified information. And my opinion, that was clearly classified information, at least on the first one. I don't know about the second one that's been released. I haven't seen that material yet.
Do you have full faith and confidence in Secretary Hegseth now?
It's not up to me to have full faith and confidence. It's up to the President of the United States, who he works for. Look, I think Pete Hegseth was bringing some really important attributes into the Department of Defense. The fact that he was a war fighter, he was, boots on the ground. He had a sense of what they needed and some of the frustrations that they felt. I wanted to see that incorporated at the upper levels so that we got a lot more of the materials to them on a more expedited basis, that decisions were based on what the warfighter needed. And I think he can be very helpful in that regard. But there has to be a recognition that certain things are not to be discussed publicly. And like I said, I think he found out that there is a woodshed at the White House. I think they found out very clearly that this is not acceptable. I think it's not just him, but several other people, I suspect were truly criticized by the White House and the president. And I don't think any one of them want to go through that again. And I have faith that the president will not allow it to happen again, and that should anything have to happen there, it'll be up to him. In the meantime, we'll continue to work with the Secretary of Defense. Our goal is to improve for the warfighter the tools and the equipment that they need. And rather than being critical of him publicly on it, I'll wait and have my discussions with him privately.
I think I mentioned President Trump suggesting moving military spending up to $1 trillion. Good move, do you think? Hesitation? What are your thoughts about that budget from $850 billion, which is the third highest line item in our national budget right now, to even more at $1
trillion? One of the reasons why DOGE is looking at the Department of Defense as well is to reattribute or redirect some of the existing funding as well. Because quite frankly, we may even need more than what has already been proposed. And the reason for that is because we have never had such threats as we have right now with regard to two different theaters of operation. If we have any kind of an aggressive move or a confrontation with China in the Pacific Rim region, we are guaranteed that we will have a conflict occur with Russia, with Iran, or with North Korea. There's just simply no question in our mind that we will have two theaters that we will have to be prepared to not only defend against, but to actually wage war in. That will cost money. And here's my suggestion to folks that say we spend too much on defense. If we don't spend the money on defense, it is our country who is at risk. And getting into a major war is something that we're going to try to avoid. One of the ways that you try to avoid getting into a major war is to make sure that people aren't challenging you, or they think that maybe, just maybe, you're at a weak point. And so our goal is to make certain that as they look at what our resources are, the ammunition that we have available, the advanced equipment that we've got available are all top-notch, and that it'll challenge what they could actually, be successful at challenging us in. As long as we can keep them thinking for sure that the risk might not be worth the reward, then I think we might be able to avoid that war. And when you talk about a war, you're talking not in terms of billions or in hundreds of billions of dollars. You're talking in costs of trillions of dollars. Mm. And I'd rather spend the extra couple of hundred billion, be safe, secure, not put our young men and women in harm's way, and maybe avoid that $1 trillion bill.
Maybe you heard this from people in South Dakota as well, but a New York Times investigative report it looked at the 238 or 230-some men who were sent to El Salvador and found only like 32 of them or so had serious criminal accusations or convictions. We heard President Trump say this week that there's not time for what most people would consider due process for people who are being deported. There's a lot of money being spent on these efforts to find people to deport them or remove them from the U.S. Do you think that these people deserve some kind of due process here in America? And second question, do you think that this is money well spent?
I liked the idea that we would do everything we could to make Americans safe, and that for people that had criminal records or that were of danger to society, that they would be the first ones to be deported or imprisoned. Having said that, we are a nation of laws, and we have to follow the laws. That's critical. So as the Supreme Court and the courts work through the different activities that the White House and that the Homeland Security and ICE is working through, It's going to be a little bit messy for a while. There's going to be challenges. But we have to, in the end, follow the law. And I expect that as the courts work their way through what is really complicated and messy, and as the administration continues to try to make darn sure that they keep Americans safe, that we get these things ironed out, and that there is a path forward where they can, have a streamlined process for getting those individuals that need to leave the country out of the country, but at the same time, not violating what the law would say with regard to expected due process. And some people will say, well, there's a difference between an American citizen and someone who is here illegally. Recognize that. But if you have legal status, then I think that can change a little bit with regard to what your expectations are of due process. I recognize it. And once again, this is going to be messy. It's going to be complicated. But the courts, when they are involved, have to be respected. And moving forward, that protects everybody. It protects all of us. And the rule of law is what is critical.
I promised you 20 minutes, Senator Rounds. We're right up against that. Anything you want to leave South Dakotans with here in our remaining 30 seconds?
There has been an impact in South Dakota with regard to some of the items on the restructuring of the executive branch of government. We've had about $20 million in grants, loans, or operations that people have talked to us about. Once again, would invite people, make contact with our offices if it's something that impacted you. We've had about 140 specific requests for assistance. We've worked our way through. Well over 40 of them have already been resolved within the agencies directly. We've had another 15 or so that we've been able to resolve. There are still a number of them that we're working on and that we're monitoring. So we invite that. So if they've got a specific someplace that we can help them with, we are open to doing that, and we'll do our best to help them work through the process.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It is an uncertain time for nonprofits. Community needs are high. Expenses and donor capacity are impacted by inflation, price increases, and stock market uncertainty. And federal contracts, once reliable, dangle in unpredictability. Now, the best time to prepare for a crisis is long before one lands on your doorstep. We reached out to Andy Patterson, president of the Sioux Falls Area Community Foundation, for an update. We asked about how the organization used something as simple as a conference room to build relationships and help other nonprofits do their work. I was just down in Centerville last night, and we had some lovely conversations about buildings. And this building in a town like Centerville, this building used to be this, and before it, it was this, and before it was that. And you are operating out of a similar situation where there is a building with a story.
Yes.
But you are writing the next chapter of that story.
Yeah, that's a fun way to put it. Yeah, we are in the old Illinois Central Railroad Depot, which is next to Sharapa Place, just off 8th Street in downtown Sioux Falls. And it's well over 100 years old, originally a passenger depot. And then had a lot of different lives. I think it was kind of abandoned, and the unofficial homeless shelter for a moment got rehabbed, and it was some offices. Before us, it was the Department of Homeland Security. Huh. And then as the Sharapa Place development was coming together, Jeff Schurschlick purchased that and redid the outside. And then we, in 2013, we renovated the building and moved in.
Yeah. Is this the place that if you're getting your picture taken for prom?
Yes.
You stand in front of
the front door. And yeah. Every year at graduation events, my wife and I were like, that's the depot. That's the depot. So, yes, it is a backdrop to many prom photos and senior pictures.
It's part of a community.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's part of people's stories and their lived experiences here.
Yeah.
And now, but inside, you have created this conference room, which, doesn't that sound flashy? We have a conference room.
Yeah.
And yet, it's a conference room with a story. What was your decision about building that out and making it function in a new way?
Yeah. So, you know, we've been there 11 years. And so usually you're not looking at renovations at that time. But looking at our facilities, one, our team is growing. And so we need to do some of those things for space. But the second is, you know, our board has looked at our organization and said, you know, part of what we do is bringing the community together around issues. And when you have a conference room that holds 8 people, and even our staff doesn't fit there, but how do we have space that's more conducive to that? And whether that's us hosting events that start those conversations, or it's other nonprofits using it, we're really excited to make sure that that's a place where good conversations are happening.
So how do you open it up to other nonprofits then? Who can use it and how?
Yeah, we're making it available to local nonprofits. So we it's not a place to host your events or galas,
right.
But if you need places for board meetings or conversations, things like that, it's available to those groups. And we have a lot of, you know, kind of what I would call related entities like the Sioux Falls Parks Foundation, Promising Futures, that already are having all of their board meetings there. And then as we continue to do different things in the community, we expect to invite people in for different conversations.
Yeah. There's a synergy to that.
Yeah.
When people are coming in and bumping up against each other, getting coffee, walking out, chatting, what are the potential ideas and innovations for the future when people are just in the same physical space?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I can limit it because, you know, community foundations, one of the cool things is we can touch any part of the community. It can be human services. It can be arts. It's just the breadth of all of those things. What's unique about a community foundation is we have this strong connection to donors. And then we also work with nonprofits on grants. And then, you know, in that kind of nexus, you see a lot of needs. And so I just envision the dialogue being all over the place as different things emerge as opportunities in Sioux Falls that we would put groups together there. And anytime nonprofits are in, it's fun for our team. We get a better chance to get to know the things they're seeing, the needs, the big ideas that they might have.
Yeah. I just got off a call before he came in with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds, and he talked about $20 million in grants, loans, or operational funds that he was aware of that had come through his staff with changes to the administration and how the Trump administration is sort of rethinking how the federal government works. People are feeling the pain of a loss of funds or a cutting of a staff, and they're trying to figure out how to regroup. So if you are a nonprofit and you are feeling an adjustment to the times for whatever that might be, political, that might just be, you know, the weather, but a drought, you're feeling an adjustment to the times. How do you sort of shore up some of the fundamentals of what you do, how you connect, you know, how do you invite donors to come into a space when there's so much uncertainty?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would say even before this administration and some of the things that Senator Rounds, I'm assuming referencing, were there were a lot of changes with inflation hitting the costs for nonprofits. A lot of the one-time dollars from COVID were going away. So that a lot of these groups were feeling it even before this moment. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what it means right now to those organizations. It's hard. The truth of it is a lot of nonprofits, a major part of their funding is from government contracts and grants. And so I don't want to say that philanthropy is just standing ready to backfill all of that if it's lost. Mm-hmm. It's really significant dollars. And so there's probably two things, I think, for organizations. One, you're going to have to evaluate what's the most important thing. And, you know, it might be the time where some of the things that are good but not best have to get trimmed. And the second is you're going to need to turn to those that care about you most for help. And I think philanthropy is important for any organization. In moments like this, it's going to be pretty crucial to reach out and start growing those dollars. Probably the hardest time to start doing that is in a crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, it would have been great to start years ago, and that's not available because it's not an automatic thing. But when it comes to growing philanthropy, you have to start with who already cares about you, who understands what you do. That usually is your volunteer board. It's the people that have been connected. And you have to tell them the need and then hopefully expand out from there.
If you know, people are looking at endowments, for example. They've done some kind of giving that is based on the future.
Yeah.
And now they're seeing, you know, a stock market might take a dip, or they've had some kind of personal emergency where they have less money than they thought. How do you work with philanthropists to figure out the changing times?
That's an important thing. I would say that a lot of our donors, they use donor advised funds, which is kind of getting jargony here, but it's an account where they've made contributions in the past to it, and they can recommend how we spend that to organizations. Mm-hmm. And so some of their giving has maybe happened in the really good times. Mm-hmm. It's available to be sent out the door right now. And so those are a really awesome tool. So for a lot of our donors, they can continue to do their giving as they always have, even though that maybe the business is performing different or they expect it might in the next couple of years. As for their, you know, what we might recommend, how they support organizations, we would say this is a moment to lean into your favorite. Like if, you know, if there's a core organizations that really have been important, that you really admire their work, double down, like go deeper with those organizations. It maybe isn't the time to launch a new initiative. It might be the time to really ask, what are some of those core needs to make sure that the services aren't lost right now?
But wait, I'm afraid the organization isn't going to be here. And if I give you this big donation and I lean into an organization that might now be in trouble of even existing 2 years from now, how do I feel about that? Walk me through that if I'm a donor.
That's a great, great thing to think about. Sustainability matters. And I think you want to invest in places that have some strength. And so that's part of what we do when we talk to donors is evaluate the effectiveness of an organization, but also what's the staying power. You probably aren't investing in overhead and things like that, if that's a question, but they might be doing great services that you want to support, even if it is for a moment in time. I think also for organizations that are maybe struggling or worried about where they're going to be in 2 years, this is a moment for them to look at partnerships. And are there organizations that could come together through a merger, some kind of shared services? Is there some opportunities to ensure they're around? It might look different, but ensure that they're still around.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about relationships and how important that is in philanthropy. How do you form them?
Yeah.
How do you build on them? We're all very, very busy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The demands on our time and resources are huge and broad. How important are those relationships and how do you secure them so that people are there for each other in tough times?
Yeah. Relationships are hard to form. It's easier to post on social media or send a letter. And there's so many messages. There's so much out there. It's hard to cut through all of that. I think it's old fashioned. I think it's people to people. And if I was going to try to ramp up fundraising, I would start with who is already connected to my organization. I think the message is really important that we're not asking for money. We need you to be a partner. You know, some of us are down in the office and we're providing the services. Others are walking alongside these clients or the work that we're doing, but we need you to be really lock arms with us and work together. And hopefully you're delivering for those donors. And then you're asking, introduce us to others. And it's really a ground game of one by one, how are you making those meaningful connections? I think people give more when they're seeing the organization up close. So it's not particularly efficient, but I also think the gifts tend to be a little bit more significant when you have that relationship focus of kind of one by one asking your volunteers to help expand your influence.
Yeah. What kind of questions should an organization be ready to answer when a new donor is looking at supporting them about getting a bang for your buck?
Yeah, I don't find that most donors are really hung up on, especially initially, like metrics, like, you know, tell me your overhead ratios and all of those types of things. There are definitely some. I think they want to know that you're competent, you're good, that you're meeting an important need. I think they want to understand that you're meeting a need not being met by somebody else. You know, donors get asked a lot, and doesn't feel good to think that there are four or five organizations doing the same thing. So how are you meeting a need no one else is? How do we know that it did anything? Is it effective? I think those are the kinds of questions you have to be able to answer.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the obvious ones, but how can you succinctly answer that? The other one is, like, what do you do? And that seems silly, but sometimes when you strip away buzzwords, like tell me what you do and how does that improve someone's life and be able to speak in plain English, I think is a really important thing that sometimes is a little bit lost.
Yeah, yeah. If I am looking for an organization to support and I'm thinking, you know, hey, I've reached that point in my career, I've reached that point in my life where I'm like, I really want to be part of this community. I feel called into action in some ways. What am I looking for? Where do you start with?
Mm-hmm.
Does that not happen very often?
It does happen sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and our team certainly works with some donors to explore that. And we're not for everybody. We do have something I'll give a plug to on the Sioux Falls Area Community Foundation website called the Giving Depot,
mm-hmm.
where we allow nonprofits to go and kind of post unique things. And sometimes that's a great way to learn about organizations that you don't you maybe otherwise didn't know about.
Yeah.
I think giving is best when it's an extension of a person's values. Like, what shaped my family and the people in my orbit? And so I think just maybe start by taking stock in your own life and say, you know, what things have mattered? You know, and to me, you're going to find more joy, probably access more of generosity if that's where it begins. And so I think, yes, looking out into needs, but start by kind of looking inside and saying, this stuff matters to me, and where does that intersect with needs that you see in the community?
Any final thoughts about your organization that you wanted to make sure you cover today before we let you go?
I mean, our job is to try to really be a cheerleader for giving in Sioux Falls, and we want to help organizations be effective. We also want donors to find joy in giving. And so just proud to do that. It's a hard season for nonprofits, and so we want to do our best to support them. I would just encourage everybody right now to really think about what's your responsibility, what's your way of giving back in your own community.
That is president of the Sioux Falls Area Community Foundation, Andy Patterson. He stopped by the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I am your host, Lori Walsh, and before we close the show today, we have asked In the Moment producer Ellen Kester to sit down with me in the studio. Welcome back, Ellen.
Hello.
All right, SDPB is dedicated to building a community to connect you with the world, and producers like Ellen Kester and Ari Youngman, who you'll hear from tomorrow, are the behind-the-scenes forces that make all this information that comes to you on In the Moment happen. So whether it is across the street, the state, the nation, or the world, our job here is to add local context to those national conversations, and we highlight conversations that are happening across the state. Become part of this community with us. Send us your gift to SDPB. You can donate online at sdpb.org or give us a call, 605-443-6963. You can also text that same number with the word give. That's 605-443-6963.
The great thing about the SDPB member community is that donations from across the state and region add up to impactful support. By everyone pitching in what they can to support public media in South Dakota, more local stories are able to be told. In fact, your gift today can actually have twice the impact to SDPB with the Van Buskirk Family Foundation $12,000 for dollar match. Your $50 gift becomes $100. Your $500 gift becomes $1,000.
Math.
Math.
It's just math, people. And it's good math. It's the best kind of math.
It's easy. A third grader can do it. A producer can do it.
A host can do it. The talent can do the math.
So donate to SDPB today and double your impact at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 605-443-6963. You can also text the word give to that number.
SDPB's local and regional news coverage connects you to your community by bringing you stories that help you get to know people and places that you might never encounter otherwise. For example, here on the In the Moment team, we have been bringing you regular conversations covering healthcare and well-being, South Dakota history and the arts. For example, we recently brought you 2 hours of conversations about the Norwegian immigration experience and the story of Giants in the Earth and an opera put on by the Symphony Orchestra. We've brought you conversations about the economy with South Dakota context, our timely long-form interviews on tariffs and the scale of the U.S. economy with Joe Santos and Everett Vandersloos up at SDSU. Those conversations helped all of us understand how the macroeconomy impacts our lives. We also bring you teacher talk and all this coverage on schools, teachers, and the educational system. There is so much happening in our communities and in our region that it is crucial that we maintain independent news source that can bring you diverse perspectives, comprehensive analysis, and engaging discussions that last more than 3 minutes. So contribute now to support that local trusted news that keeps you connected to more than just your neighborhood. It keeps South Dakota connected to the world. Call 605-443-6963. Go online, sdpb.org/donate. In the moment, we are here for you 3 times a day during the week. You can tune in at 9 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Central. If you're on the Black Hills time and in Mountain time, it is 8 a.m., 11, and 6 p.m. 3 times throughout the entire day, you are hearing this coverage. We're here for you all day long.
And behind every headline, story, and program, our commitment and your generous support is always the indispensable key to making it all possible. Please be here for SDPB right now. It's easiest to give online at sdpb.org/donate or call in your contribution to 605-443-6963. SDPB is here for all of us because of all of us.
So it's spring in South Dakota, and we want you to enjoy the great outdoors. We have a special thank you gift for that occasion with a donation of $10 a month or a one-time gift of $120. You could pick up as your thank you gift an annual South Dakota State Park vehicle pass. This pass gives you access to more than 50 state parks and recreational areas across the state, and it's good through May of 2026. I use mine all the time. Love it. Join SDPB today at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963. Begin to plan your next adventure right in your own backyard. And you can also text that number with the word give to donate.
Maybe you listen to SDPB as you get ready in the morning, or while you drink your morning beverage of choice. SDPB has a brand new coffee mug that you can pick up as a thank you gift with your donation today. It's a 17-ounce all-black mug with SDPB Always on the outside. That is going in Lori Walsh's cupboard.
I just love that. SDPB Always.
Always. Donate $84 or $7 per month by calling 605-443-6963 or go online to sdpb.org/donate to grab your very own SDPB mug. You'll be a coffee mug bestie with Lori Walsh. Get your news like you get your coffee, hot, fresh off the press with SDPB. You are the essential partner powering the critical resources SDPB requires to investigate stories deeply, report truth fearlessly, and make it all accessible to anyone, anywhere, anytime. Please contribute now, $60, $90, $120, to help uphold this service you value and use. It's easiest to give online at sdpb.org/donate or call in your contribution to 605-443-6963.
And we will wrap up today because that is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh here with Ellen Kester. And for our youngling, we thank you for listening.